When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Nothing's better than feeling comfortable in your own shoes. Maybe you're a parent raising a little rock star or a tech nomad working from anywhere. Allbirds wants you to be comfortable in your actual shoes too. Their wool runners, pipers, and loungers are so cozy, you might forget you're wearing them. And they're crafted from natural materials that tread lightly on our planet. So get comfortable in your shoes. Get to know the wool runners, pipers, and loungers at allbirds.com. That's allbirds.com.
You're listening to Unexplained, Into the Abyss, Part 2. It has been some 20-odd years since Dr. Leachy's interpretation of the Flagstone Code, and the rumours of buried riches on Oak Island have reached mythical proportions. Due to complications of ownership, it isn't until 1893 that a fourth team are able to secure the $30,000 lease agreement to begin the next assault on what many believe to be the hiding place of the long-lost treasure of infamous pirate, Captain William Kidd. On first arriving at the site, the new group of treasure hunters, led by a Frederick Blair, known as the Oak Island Treasure Company, find it much changed from Donald MacInnes' day. The once lush green grove, now an open wound, scarred and pockmarked, with numerous holes full of water. Like many before them, the company make a start digging fresh holes and making industrial strength efforts to drain the seawaters away. But just as before, the same problems persist. In March 1897, labourer Maynard Kaiser is helping to drag water up from one of the pits when the bucket snags on the rope. After ordering the men to stop, he is fixed to the pulley system before lowering himself into the pit, the bottom of which lies somewhere in the dark, 90 feet below him. Carefully easing himself in line with the bucket, he has just untangled it when the rope gives a sudden jerk, slipping 2 feet before being caught again on the pulley. A greatly relieved Kaiser has just enough time to look up before the rope jerks loose again, sending the unfortunate Kaiser disappearing into the darkness below. He becomes the second man to die in pursuit of the supposed treasure of Oak Island. With the rest of the team too shocked and saddened to return to work, the operation is brought to an immediate halt. That night, deep in sleep, one of the workers turns restlessly in his bed. Somewhere inside his head, he is visited by the spectre of Captain Kidd, who delivers a terrifying warning. Cease digging now, or else more will die. With news of the nightmare permeating the camp, the crew refused to return to work. It will be a year before the Oak Island Treasure Company are able to start digging again. This time, the team begin with another exploration of the material below the bottom of the pit. The discovery of what seems to be loose pieces of metal buried at approximately 150 feet, as well as a small piece of parchment bearing the Roman numeral for the number 6, only serves to convince the company further that they are not on a hiding to nothing. Despite extensive efforts to plug the tunnels from Smith's Cove, the boreholes continue to flood. In response, an engineer suggests putting a red dye into one of the pits so they can find out precisely where the waters are coming from. With a small team assembled to the east above Smith's Cove, the dye is poured into the hole. After nearly an hour of waiting, however, they have seen nothing. But then, one of the crew spots it. A garish wash of red, bleeding into the sea, from the south shoreline. Realizing they had been plugging the wrong tunnels all along, the team undertake a sustained process of dynamiting along the southern edge of the dig site in the hope of uncovering the real flood tunnel. But just like the many previous efforts, having only brought further destruction to the increasingly scarred landscape, the company draws a blank. With enthusiasm for the work beginning to wane, company founder Frederick Blair buys out the remaining shares and in 1905 takes full ownership of the license to dig on the island. For the next 25 years, he leases it out to a variety of unsuccessful ventures. And by the early 1930s, as described by Frederick Griffin in the Toronto Star Weekly, where once the ground above Smith's Cove was littered with the majestic oaks that gave the island its name, by now there were barely half a dozen left, clinging on for dear life. The land has become a battlefield of torn earth and empty boreholes. In 1935, steel magnate Gilbert Hedden is the next to answer the siren call of treasure, purchasing half the island and a digging lease from Blair. After 3 years and $50,000, just under $1 million today, Hedden's team make a number of interesting discoveries, finding a miner's oil lamp, some dynamite buried at 65 feet, as well as an as-yet undiscovered chamber that appears to have been one of the original flood tunnels. The problem being, it is almost impossible to tell if any of these artifacts had been left prior to 1795. It has also become impossible to tell which hole exactly was the original pit that started the whole adventure off in the first place. Hedden gives up in 1938. When Frederick Blair dies in 1951, the site lease reverts to Mel Chappell, who had been a partner of Blair's 20 years previously. Chappell had also been one of the diggers who witnessed Maynard Kaiser fall to his death. Though it was said that Chappell had once himself seen gold flakes coming off a drill during one of the earlier excavations, he had no interest in seeking the treasure, remembering all too well the warning from his colleague that death stalked all who sought it. It was in 1959 that Robert and Mildred Restall negotiated a deal with Mel Chappell to try their luck at cracking the mystery. In the 1950s, Robert and his wife Mildred worked a travelling show called The Globe of Death, which involved the married couple riding motorbikes around a metal sphere at 65 miles per hour. The pair travelled the world before settling in Canada. It was at some point in the 1950s that the daredevils got wind of the intriguing treasure hunt occurring on Oak Island. Soon after agreeing a lease with Chappell, Robert and his son Bobby moved to the island to begin work and are joined by the rest of the family soon after. The following year, they succeed in pumping out almost all the water from the main shaft. For the next 5 years, however, the family struggled to keep the water held back long enough to make a thorough exploration of the site. Once again, the treasure remains tantalizingly out of reach. In August 1965, Robert and Mildred are preparing to head to nearby Chester to run a number of errands when Robert heads to the site to make a final check on a new gasoline pump. The pump had been installed next to one of the new shafts that they had been digging at Smith's Cove. Telling him not to take too long, Mildred watched her husband as he stepped into the muggy afternoon air and made his way down to the cove. A few miles away on the mainland, Jim Kaiser, one of the Restall's key labourers, was carrying out some chores at home. Though he wasn't scheduled to work that day, he had the most peculiar desire to stop what he was doing immediately and head to Oak Island. Back above Smith's Cove, as Robert nears the shoreline, he is overcome by a strange smell of rotten eggs. It seems to be emanating from one of the newly dug pits. Robert's son Bobby is helping to burn waste materials when he looks up to see his father peering down at something from the edge of the pit, before going stiff and falling straight in. Bobby tears down to the cove, only to find his father's lifeless body floating in the water at the bottom of the pit. Moments later, everything goes black as he too loses consciousness and falls straight into the hole. Another worker, Carl Grazer, who had witnessed the whole thing, races to the edge of the pit. Seeing the two bodies in the water, he has only just reached the top of a ladder descending into it when he becomes the third man to lose consciousness, falling from the ladder with a splash into the hole. He is in turn followed by worker Cyril Hiltz, who has made it halfway down the ladder before he too succumbs to the strange fumes. In the pandemonium, a further two workers, Andrew Dumont and Leonard Kaiser, attempting to rescue the others, make it as far as the water before their bodies give up too. Incredibly, New York firefighter Captain Edward White, who just happens to be visiting the dig site at the time, is miraculously able to pull Kaiser and Dumont free. But for the others, it is too late. Back at Jim Kaiser's home, there is a frantic knock at the door. He opens it to find his uncle in a desperate state, with some terrible news. Jim immediately races to Oak Island to find a team of firefighters assembled at the top of Smith's Cove, trying to figure out the safest way to retrieve the bodies. Without thinking, Jim borrows a vintage Second World War gas mask from one of them and jumps straight into the hole. One by one, he pulls out the dead bodies of his friends. Are you always taking care of your family? Do you often take care of others and not yourself? Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. You deserve it. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best, to feeling like yourself again. With Teladoc, you can speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video. Therapy appointments are available 7 days a week from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time. If you feel overwhelmed sometimes, maybe you feel stressed or anxious, depressed or lonely, or you might be struggling with a personal or family issue, Teladoc can help. Teladoc is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy to change counsellors if needed, for free. Teladoc Therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast. The tragic death of the men, especially both Robert and Bobby Restall, marks the end of the Restall involvement with Oak Island, with Mildred having no interest in pursuing what is starting to look increasingly like a cursed errand. Ownership of the lease is transferred to Robert Dunfield. In the summer of 1965, the bullish Dunfield wastes little time in bulldozing 12 feet away from the surface of the original pit and uses the resultant clay to clog any tunnels coming up from Smith's Cove. Next, he constructs a causeway joining the island to the mainland for the first time. Back in 1963, businessman Fred Nolan discovered that unbeknownst to Restall and Robert Dunfield at the time, a few minor lots of Oak Island were still available to purchase. After swiftly buying them up, he undertakes a few minor excavations, but finds little of interest. However, with the construction of Dunfield's causeway, Nolan is excited at the prospect of getting better equipment to continue his search. But Dunfield refuses to let him use it. What he hadn't realised, however, was that Crandall's Point, the land abutting the causeway, was also still available to purchase. When Nolan finds out, he buys it immediately, denying all access from the causeway. The petty stalemate results in Dunfield quitting the project for good and returning to his native California. Some might say he got off lightly. Only a few weeks prior to Dunfield's voluntary eviction, Jim Kaiser, who had stayed on to assist Dunfield, is spending the night at the dig site in the old Restall family home when he wakes to find the whole cabin shaking violently while having the sensation of a heavy weight on his chest. Looking up moments later, he was confronted by a pair of red eyes staring at him from out of the darkness. Running from the bed in terror, he heads straight outside into the cold night air, but finds no sign of anybody. The next morning, having finally got back to sleep, Kaiser finds his body covered in bruises, including 5 on his arm, long and thin, as if a hand had gripped him there. It wasn't long after that reports of a genuine curse first came to light that warned specifically that 7 treasure hunters would have to die before the island gave up its treasure. With the construction worker scolded in 1861 and Maynard Kaiser's fall of 1897 added to the horrific quadruple tragedy of the Restall operation, so far there had been 6. By 1969, in the 174 years since Donald MacInnis, John Smith, and Anthony Vaughan first uncovered evidence of a potential treasure pit, not one person had succeeded in digging down any further than the 90-foot bottom carved out by the Onslow Company in 1803. But all that was about to change. It was in April of 1969 that businessmen Daniel Blankenship and David Tobias formed the Triton Alliance, buying up the majority of the island and moving in at the first opportunity. In what was by far the most sophisticated operation to date, the Alliance begins by digging 60 different boreholes close to the original pit to draw up a detailed plan of the geology underneath. They soon discover the bedrock to be located at roughly 160 feet below. But incredibly, there also seems to be some kind of wooden layer 40 feet below this. The following year, labourers uncover evidence of what could well have been the original dam constructed at Smith Cove to create the original flood tunnels. A set of logs laid out in a U-shape with Roman numerals carved into them. They also discover a litany of artefacts, including wrought iron scissors an iron ruler, and a wooden sled that predate the time before Donald MacInnes first spotted something in 1795. But the best is yet to come. Since there was no way of preventing the seawater flooding the now myriad tunnels and boreholes, and with the risk of structural collapse too high to send people down them, the team construct a vast 27-inch diameter steel pipe, which they hope will allow for direct access to underneath the dig site. In spring 1971, the team choose a borehole numbered 10X for the purpose, and proceeded to carve it out to a depth of 235 feet before threading the pipe down it all the way to the bottom. What made 10X so special was that they had good reason to believe it led directly to an artificial cavity that had at some point been dug out of the bedrock. Before sending anyone down, however, Blankenship and Tobias decided to use a camera to first investigate what was down there. With the team set up on the edge of borehole 10X, they gathered excitedly around a bulky TV monitor as the camera was slowly lowered down. They watched with profound anticipation as it dropped deeper through the casing, through the pitch black of the water, and finally out into the open of the chamber below. Squinting at the monitor, they see soft, angular shapes beginning to emerge from out of the darkness, things which seemed foreign to the surrounding geology, all covered over in a thick layer of silt. And one shape, more recognizable than the others, protruding from out of the mud. The arm of a skeleton. Believing they had finally unearthed the location of the fabled treasure, the Triton team employ a diver to take a closer look. In October 1971, Alan Sagar, a retired lieutenant commander and former demining expert, answers the call. With the casing too narrow to wear an oxygen tank, Sagar is forced to hug a small bottle of compressed air to his chest as he is lowered manually on steel cable into the pipe. And with no radio communication, Sagar and the crew have only the cable with which to give each other signals. At 90 feet down, feeling the chill of the water at his feet, Sagar tugs on the cable for the winch team to stop. Adjusting his mouthpiece, he gives another two tugs and is soon descending again, dropping steadily until he is completely submerged under the water in total darkness. He soon descends past the 150-foot level, then 200 feet, until finally he emerges out the bottom end and into the cavity. Sagar takes a moment to compose himself before turning on the camera, the images of which are being fed back live to the surface, and points it into the space. Turning on his torch, he directs it into the gloom. Suddenly, he can see everything. Unexpectedly, the cavern that stretched off some distance behind was much bigger than had been first assumed. On the floor of it, just as the previous footage had revealed, there appear to be a number of oblong containers and a pole, perhaps the handle of a tool, poking up from out of the soft mud. And sure enough, there to the side of it, the arm of a skeleton reaches up out of the silt. Back on the surface, crowded around the monitor, a nervous excitement is spreading throughout the team as they struggle to contain themselves. But then, Sagar takes a step forward into the cavern, instantly sending a vast cloud of silt billowing up into the space, blocking out the light. Realizing he can no longer proceed, Sagar has little choice but to get back into the pipe and head back to the surface. Once in place, he tugs twice again on the cable and is greatly relieved when moments later, he feels it taking his weight and lifting him upwards. At just over halfway, with Sega still submerged some distance underwater, he has the strange sensation that he is being pulled back into the pipe. He realizes with horror that it is the suit, caught on one of the welds in the pipeline. Unaware of what has happened, the workers above continue to winch him up. But with Sega's body unwilling to budge, the suit is beginning to pull apart. And now, the breathing apparatus is coming undone as well. Sega pulls furiously on the cable, while simultaneously struggling to free himself. When finally, something dislodges, and he is suddenly free once again, being pulled steadily up to the surface. After Sega's close call, 9 other divers are tasked with helping to retrieve the apparent items from the cavity at the bottom of hole 10X, but none are successful. In 1976, Daniel Blankenship tries to enter the cavern himself. However, having only made it halfway down the pipe, Blankenship hears the ominous sound of creaking steel, which is followed by a cascade of debris falling on his head from above. Sensing imminent danger, Blankenship demands an immediate evacuation. Miraculously, he is pulled free just as the casing collapses completely below him. When the 27-inch wide steel piping is dug out later, they discover a section of it has been entirely closed in. To some, the cavity at 235 feet deep and the items allegedly spotted in it is the strongest evidence that a genuine hoard of treasure has been stashed away on the island. Others have questioned whether it may have in fact only been created by dynamiting that had been carried out by the Triton Alliance some time prior to its discovery. Either way, like all others before them, Blankenship and Tobias will leave the island empty-handed. And though many others, even to this day, have since attempted to unlock the island's secrets, it resolutely refuses to give them up. Or so it was thought. In a startling revelation that has only recently come to light, it was claimed by Fred Nolan that in 1980, whilst digging in a region just above the South Shore, known as the Swamp, he discovered 3 old and empty oak chests. Then, something else came to light. Thanks to the extensive research carried out on the subject of the Oak Island treasure by the fantastic Blockhouse investigation team, it seems those empty chests just might have been rediscovered before. In fact, all the way back in 1795. According to Carl Mosher, who had taken part in some of the earlier excavations, in 1925, his grandmother, Lucy Vaughan, a descendant of Anthony Vaughan, one of the first discoverers of the pit, had taken him into the basement of her home and shown him an old-looking chest made of oak. Opening it up, it was revealed to contain 25 white canvas bags, each stuffed with gold coins, that she said had come from Oak Island. And then, in a 2007 newspaper interview, a descendant of Donald MacInnes made a similarly startling revelation. In the weeks after Donald uncovered the first signs of the pit in 1795, he, John Smith and Anthony Vaughan, had in fact also uncovered 3 separate chests stuffed full of loot. It had long been believed in the MacInnes, now known as MacInnes, family, that on finding the treasure, the men had sworn to secrecy, agreeing never to reveal the truth of it to anyone. After all, there's no telling what lengths people will go to when told there is treasure to be found. Thank you to Andrew Maddox for bringing this fantastic story to my attention. If you enjoy listening to Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now go to unexplainedpodcast.com/support. All donations, no matter how large or small, are massively appreciated. All elements of Unexplained are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show on iTunes. Feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or on Twitter at unexplainedpod. Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best. Speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video anytime between 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time, 7 days a week. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast.
With the best all-inclusive vacation deals to Mexico and the Caribbean, booking your getaway with Cheap Caribbean Vacations means you have more freedom to do your deal. Whether you want to enjoy snorkeling, endless margaritas and more, or simply soak up the sun and sand in a tropical paradise, Cheap Caribbean Vacations has your deal for that. Plan and book the exact getaway you want at exactly the right price for you by using our exclusive budget beach finder, or find a featured all-inclusive package to Generations Riviera Maya Resort and do your deal at CheapCaribbean.com.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Lisa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit lisa.com/iHeart. That's LEESA.com/iHeart.
Let me run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. Legal Shield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract's fine print, or you finally want to get that will done? Legal Shield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.